Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today they've let me fly solo as a solo host. Although I am on my own in a cockpit, I do have a very cool guest joining me today. He is a watch collector, he's an interesting guy, and co-founder of the Horology Club, a horological enthusiast community based in Hong Kong. His name is Helbert. So, hey, Helbert, welcome to Fifth Wrist Radio.
Thank you, Roman. Thank you for having me. Such an honor to be here. I'm a big fan of the show, so, you know, I'm just so glad to be here speaking with you today.
Oh, I'm so glad I paid for that endorsement. That was lovely. Thank you. Beautifully done. You just kind of slid that in conversation. Now, look, this is very, very, very kind of you to say. You and I have been kind of chatting on and off, trying to get this conversation to happen for about 6 months, I think. Really good to finally connect. So it's really, really awesome. Usually, you know, the way we kick off, we'll do a quick drink check, wrist check, and actually let's throw in a location check as well, and then we'll roll into it, eh? What do you think?
Sounds good.
You can go first. Yeah, definitely. I think it's the only appropriate thing to do. You go.
Okay.
You go.
Maybe location check first, you know.
Yep.
As you said earlier, I'm one of the co-founders of the Horology Club, which is based in Hong Kong. So naturally, I'm in Hong Kong right now. You know, Hong Kong still has a quite stringent COVID restriction, so it hasn't been possible for me to travel for a while. But, you know, once that's possible, it'll be good to maybe see you in Australia or go visit Switzerland for a Swiss watch tour. Onto the drinks check. I'm drinking a whiskey soda that I made just maybe 10 minutes ago. Yeah.
Usually done.
Based on the Laphroaig 10 years, one of my favorites.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And on the wrist check today, I'm wearing the Mad One.
Ah, oh, very nice. Yes. Subject of your latest video. Very nice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a fidget spinner for the wrist.
Yes. Yes. I think you're the first actual owner that I know that I've actually spoken with. I want to know your impressions and, you know, whether they're favorable or less favorable will depend on what will make it into the final broadcast, but I will want to know your actual opinion about it. But it's a very cool watch. Looking at it from afar, it's a very cool, very cool release. So
absolutely.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah. Definitely something cool we can get into later.
Definitely. Oh, I'm 100%. Very cool. All right. Well, I'll do my side of things. So location wise, people know, you know, I'm based in Melbourne. You've got COVID restrictions precluding you from travel at your end. I'm actually currently at home locked in with COVID. So I'm definitely not going anywhere for a little while. So definitely firmly in Melbourne.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. Look, yeah, look, I'm okay. You know, if I fall asleep midway through the conversation, it's not you. It's very much the virus. Let's go. You know, we'll go with that. No, look, I'm okay. It's been a bit of a drain, but we don't need to talk about that. So I'm here, ready. Drinks-wise, my drink choice will be disappointing. One of the things I've discovered with coronavirus and alcohol, I just fall asleep. It's like somebody pulls a pin out of like a, you know, like a marionette, you know, someone cuts the strings, I just kind of collapse. So I'm just drinking tea, which is disappointing, but you know, what can you do? And wrist check wise, very hard to know what to wrist check with you. Cause we'll get into your collecting. You're into indies. I get that. That's why you and I click. Very hard to know what to wear. The watch I went with is possibly what you may know, not be too familiar with. I've got a James Lamb on the wrist.
Oh, I've seen these. I've seen these on Instagram. He's a British watchmaker, right?
He is, yeah. So this is watch number one from his series.
Oh,
so this is the very first one he made. Yeah, so James is a independent watchmaker working in Lincoln in the UK. So it's a, you know, he hand makes the case, hand makes the dial, hand make crowns. Yeah, he's like a sweetheart of a guy. He's recently launched. So yeah, so this is watch number one and he's now got orders popping up. So really exciting to see him kind of blossom. So that's what I thought. I thought I'd wear something that you might not have seen before. Or at least haven't seen too many of. I'm not sure if any have made it to Hong Kong yet. I suspect not with James Lamb, but hopefully there'll be some coming.
So yeah, it's not something I've seen in person, so, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing that. But the colourful dial definitely appeals to me a lot.
Yeah, look, and he's done really well. I mean, they're very, very interesting. They're beautifully made, and they do play with light really, really well. And that's kind of one of the things I wanted to... that's the reason I picked this watch is I know some of the watches in your collection certainly play with light in an interesting way. I know you've got Urbex and a few other things, and even the Mad One really plays with light. That spinning thing really plays with light. So I thought that might be appropriate.
Amazing.
Awesome. Alrighty, beautiful. Alrighty, well, probably the next logical way for us to start is maybe you're the guest. So let's put you on the spot. Let's do a bit of a... Tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, kind of, you know, what made you go get into watches, you know, your favorite color, you know, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? You know, just the basics kind of thing, you know, just kind of your dating profile, essentially, is what we're after, what we're after here.
I'll try to stick to the watches.
Sure. So, don't limit yourself, but go for it.
Yes. So I'm Hilbert. I'm one of the co-founders of the Horology Club in Hong Kong. So I guess, you know, I live a double life. One part of it, I'm an insurance professional. And the other part, I'm a co-founder of one of the, what we call horological enthusiast communities in Hong Kong. So before I talk about the community, maybe I'll just talk a little bit about my personal watch journey then. I guess I started quite young. You know, one of the earliest watches that I remember having is either a digital watch or a Swatch with a dial that celebrates the 1994 Olympics.
Which is Atlanta? What's 90? Yeah, which one's Atlanta, 94?
Yeah.
Atlanta, there you go.
Yeah, Atlanta in the US. I mean, back then, I guess I didn't really know much about watches, but I did find them fascinating. Mm. And I remember wearing it everywhere, you know, when I go to school, when I get home. But yeah. I guess it wasn't until I was a little bit older when my dad talked to me about his Rolex. And wow. I remember him saying that, oh, you know, like, look, you know, this watch, the secondhand glides. And I was really fascinated by that because before then, all the watches that I've seen had ticking secondhand.
Sure.
So, yeah, I guess when I was 18, my dad gifted me that Rolex of his. It was a stainless steel Datejust.
Wow.
Yeah, since then, I guess, you know, that kind of kickstarted my journey. And then a few years later, you know, when I started working, you know, I started reading up a lot more about watches. I started collecting watches, you know, I started with brands like IWC and Rolex, which still fascinates me to this day. And then my journey just slowly moved on. And like you said, you know, I'm very big into independent watches right now. But I would say my taste is still quite diverse. I like quite a lot of different watches. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Before we get into it, I'm fascinated by the dad speaking to his son about the ticking seconds hand thing. I need to explore this. Just treat this as like a therapy session, you know. Let's explore this. Is that a – so I'm going to try to rephrase this question into an appropriate thing. Is that part of the culture? Is that a common sort of – is that a common conversation that an, you know, father would have with the son about watches when they get to a certain age because there is a gift or a watch coming to a – young man who becomes an adult? Is that a common thing? Or is it just your dad who was into watches and thought, hey, he's old enough, he'll understand the difference between ticking and gliding, so I'll just tell him that? I'm just kind of fascinated by that.
No, I mean, okay. So I don't particularly think this discussion is a cultural thing. Like, I think okay. I was a quite curious kid, and I guess my dad just wanted me show me his new watch then. And, you know, I was a curious kid, so I asked all the questions, and I guess, you know, that's how the conversation came about. But just hitting on the cultural point you was talking about, I guess in Hong Kong, there's a very strong watch culture. You know, people would call Hong Kong one of the watch capitals of the world. You know,
100%.
See people, you know, your bus driver would be wearing a Rolex, you know, your taxi driver would be wearing a Rolex. Like,
absolutely.
You just see a real luxury watches. Right? Yeah.
But a real one. So, yeah. Yes, cool. Yeah, gotcha.
So I would say watch culture is pretty much ingrained in Hong Kong's people's minds. So, you know, you could be hitting on something, and maybe other fathers would have had this conversation with their sons as well that I'm unaware of.
Okay. Yeah, that is really interesting, because you're right. Certainly from Australia, you know, looking at Hong Kong is definitely seen as, you know, a really not just a place where there are a lot of watches, but people are very knowledgeable about watches as well. You know, it's not just sort of everyone wears a really blingy loud or everyone has a Rolex. No, it's actually there is some deep knowledge and appreciation really kind of embedded in the culture. So I find that really interesting. Really, I mean, that's a wonderful thing, but that is really interesting. Why do you think that is? Do you have sort of a theory of why, you know, I mean, you were just kind of lucked into a country where you live in a country that, you know, really appreciates watch. I just wonder if you have a theory why that is.
I'm not too sure, actually. I mean, it could be down to you know, Chinese people could like alternative assets.
Right. So you think it's a utilitarian thing? You know, like, because I wondered, you know, is it a subtle way for people to show status? Because,
it could be a bling thing.
bling thing is one, but I just wondered, you know, I live in Australia, which is, you know, there's a lot of space in theory, you know, not unless you listen to our politicians who say, no, the country's full. We don't even need to go down the bullshit thing of no immigration. But, you know, there's a lot of space. So one way people show status here or can show status here is, you know, you build a bigger house or you add another floor to your house or, you know, you expand your geographic footprint, if you like. Now, I would imagine that's less of a possibility in Hong Kong, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, for men, I guess the watch is the primary piece of jewelry that someone has. So, you know,
I'm so glad I thought you were going to go with a different analogy for men. So, you know, I thought you were going to a different. So, no, you're right. So you went with jewelry. Yeah. That's a much better, much more elevated.
The car you drive, you know, it could be.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, look, and this is really fascinating for me. Is it because, you know, I grew up in the Soviet Union, which doesn't really have watch culture to speak of at all. But it is now that I talk to friends in Russia now and Ukraine as well, which is where I'm from originally, you know, they're kind of catching up, particularly younger kind of Russians and Ukrainians who are, you know, professionals starting to make money. It's definitely a way to show your status. And and that's why there's sort of this rapacious appetite for luxury watches, not just watches, but luxury goods of all sort of, mark, bags, leather goods, shoes, anything, suits, anything, you know, because it's definitely a way to show status, but they often, it's a newly emerging appreciating market. So there's less connoisseurship, but more visible luxury. If you know what I mean. Whereas I definitely don't see that in Hong Kong. At least in Hong Kong, it tends to be this kind of definitely much more subtle way of showing, appreciating watches on the connoisseurship level. So yeah, I find that interesting. Sorry, you know, we're getting down like a deep rabbit hole, but I find it fascinating. So people will kind of bear with us.
On that note, I guess, you know, you, You could say that watch culture is becoming more and more prevalent these days, whether sure. it be Hong Kong or any other region.
Yeah,
really.
That's true.
And
that's
even
true.
Even within Hong Kong, you know, a lot of the collectors that I meet have only got into this hobby maybe in the past 2 to 3 years. So I guess
really, yeah, wow, it, okay, interesting.
It could be a number of reasons that is making watch culture much more popular.
Yeah, interesting,
but. Also, you know, from what you said, I used to live in the UK, and when I first started getting into watches, I was living in the UK then, and back then I realized that actually, like, most of the people that I meet don't really wear luxury watches, so, you know, it's probably not just an Australian thing.
Sure.
I don't know about these. I don't know about these days, but
Right. No, you're right. And so, in Hong Kong, is there a strong male versus female breakdown, or do you get sort of, you know, women wearing luxury watches, appreciating watches at a similar level to men?
I would say that it is mostly on a similar level. It may be slightly less, but you know, from what I've observed, it would be on a similar level. You know, it is not uncommon to see women wearing luxury watches in Hong Kong, but having said that, maybe the split between the genders for connoisseurship would be leaning towards male.
I mean, it is really interesting because I mean, certainly in my experience in Australia, you know, it's much more male, you know, any get together is very much, you know, it's just dudes, you know, with with occasionally either one or two really cool girls who are really into watches, or more likely two or three really bored girls who just got dragged in because they were promised a dinner out and somehow they've ended up at this get together and you can see this sort of fight going on. When can we leave? You promised it's only half an hour and we've been here for 3 hours. Can we go home now? Kind of, you know, you could see relationships breaking, the marriages on the line essentially at every get together, but it's definitely very much more a male thing. So no, that's very, very cool. The way you describe it makes me wish I moved to Hong Kong. Definitely a place to be.
You're very welcome to come and visit us and join one of our get-togethers when you're in.
That's very kind. Well, let's see how this conversation goes. You might be retracting that invitation by the end of this chat. So, but thank you. That's really kind. All right, very cool. So you're getting into watches. So we'll get back to you now because you're the object of my fascination today. So you start getting into watches and then, you know, you start with mainstream brands, which is very common. You know, I think that's kind of the well-trodden path, which is exactly how things work. What made you kind of turn more towards independent watches as kind of an area that really grabbed your attention?
Well, I would say that in the beginning, you know, when I first started out, of course, I had a limited budget. I still have a limited budget.
Sure.
But I was younger then, and I couldn't really afford these incredible, creative, independent watches. But, you know, even when I first started, I was still fascinated by these watches. You know, I still remember when the HM4 first came out, and I was just looking at this web page with a watch that looks like a plane. I was like, oh my god, this just looks crazy. Yeah. Or looking at stuff like the Devon Treads, the Uvercs, like those are the watches that have always fascinated me. But I guess what sort of pushed me towards it in the past few years is, you know, firstly, my income has gone up, so I can, you know, afford these watches.
You can play in that ballpark now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, yes. And now that I can do that, then of course I'll go back and I'll buy all the pieces that I've always been fascinated by, the pieces that when they first came out, that I just, you know, really wanted, but couldn't afford.
Right. See, that's interesting. So you're now going back and buying the, and trying to obtain the stuff that you couldn't. Yeah, that's really interesting. That is really interesting. Yeah. So what was, if you don't mind me asking, what was the first indie, in inverted commas, watch that really grabbed your attention that you bought, that you thought, no, I have to have this. I can afford it now, but it's a significant investment, whatever it is, whatever price range it was. What was the one that kind of actually lured you into that, you know, sliding pit of despair that we all inhabit called watch collecting?
That would have to be the FP Jean Chronomètre Bleu.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I still remember when I first heard about FP Jean, and then the tagline to his brand is like, you know, he invented it and he made it up. This guy is so arrogant, but the stuff that he makes is amazing. You know, like, I remember reading about like a T30 Tourbillon and all of these amazing watches that he had.
Yeah. But
the first time I found out about the Chronomètre Bleu is from the Hodinkee 3-on-3 video. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Oh, yeah. What are the others in that thing?
One of them is the Vacheron Patrimony.
Okay, right.
And the Lange 1815.
Right. Okay, yeah. So, okay. Yeah. I think I was thinking of a different 3-on-3. I think we'd had like a Speak Marin and a Sarpaneva, but that must have been a different thing. But anyway, sorry, go on. Okay. Yeah.
And I remember seeing that watch and I thought, oh, that blue dial just looks absolutely amazing. Mm. And then I think after that, I visited Geneva.
Right. And always a mistake. always dangerous, yeah.
I actually saw the Chronomètre Bleu in the showcase in the boutique in Geneva. Oh, wow.
Young people listening to this episode, that doesn't happen anymore. So, you know, this was in time where watches actually existed in display windows, right?
yeah, exactly. And at that time, you know, like, I guess I couldn't quite afford the watch, so I had to let that chance go. But, you know, a few years down the line, you know, I had the chance to own it. And I just thought, you know, I just have to go for it.
No, fair enough. Yeah, if you get a chance to do it, do it. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because that is, I mean, it's a lovely watch. It's a beautiful watch. It's gone a bit crazy price wise and all that now, but we don't even need to touch that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But no, the watch itself is really beautiful, but it is very classic. You know, it is the proportions. It is very, very classic, which is really interesting because that was the watch that kind of the indie watch that lured you into the craziness. Because I know looking at your collection now and probably the direction it took, you know, you've kind of gone with really much more avant-garde. Well, look at the watch you've got now, you know, wearing at the moment. It's a much more avant-garde thing. That's really interesting.
I've heard people say that about my collecting, but at the same time, I'm still very much fascinated by classical watchmaking. And I guess one of the things that I really enjoy about the Chronomètre Bleu is, while it's still classical looking, which is the same as a lot of FP Jean's work, you know, with the tantalum case, with the fascinating blue dial, and combined with that gold movement, I feel like, you know, that's a killer combination. Sure. You can wear it with a suit, you can wear it with, you know, t-shirt and shorts, and it'll still look good. It'll look good with any color strap you put on it. And
true.
I guess that's what really, you know, what I really liked about it.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you can't be faulted for it. It's a glorious watch. Absolutely. No question. Is there a bit of a Jean community in inverted commas in Hong Kong? You know, is he one of the indie brands that really brings Hong Kong collectors together?
I think there are a lot of collectors in Hong Kong who likes FP Jean. And we do have an FP Jean boutique here in Hong Kong.
Right.
So that kind of contributes to it as well. But I haven't really discovered a community that sort of, you know, focuses purely on Jean. Okay.
Yeah, but, interesting.
You know, we're not short of big Jean collectors in Hong Kong or even in our horology club community as well.
Yeah. Well, actually, well, now it's probably a perfect example. Let's talk about the Horology Club. So you're one of the co-founders. Let's talk about what was the impetus for setting it up? What is it? What happens behind closed doors?
Okay. Like you said, I'm one of the three co-founders of the Horology Club.
Yeah.
We started off actually as, friends who just happened to, all be into horology. But, after a bit, we thought, okay, why don't we just expand this community publicly? We all want to meet more watch collectors. So, we just started organizing, public get-togethers, trying to see if we can get anyone to join. The first time we did it, we thought, okay, maybe there's going to be like four or five people coming. It could just be, three of us and one or two other guys.
It's a party.
We started in the cigar bar, and then, there were like 20-something people who showed up.
Oh, wow.
And then, afterwards, we started doing monthly get-togethers, and the size just, kept on growing. And now, after close to a year, we have around 100 members.
Wow.
We still do large-scale get-togethers whenever we can. The past few months have been a bit hard because we had the fifth wave of COVID in Hong Kong, where we had a lot of social restrictions. But, usually our large scale events, they attract around 50 to 60 of our members to join.
Yeah, wow.
So it's quite fascinating. We're still getting, a lot of requests to come to our events. And, it's a good community. But I guess the ethos behind our club is that, we want to be an open and inclusive community for all types of watch collectors in Hong Kong. It doesn't matter if you're collecting Seiko or if you're collecting FP Jean, we welcome all kinds of people who are into watches. We like to focus on in-person events because we really believe in, just getting a touch and feel of the watch. Sometimes you see like a press release photo and there's just no way of assessing whether that watch is right for you.
Definitely.
How it feels on the wrist, right? And just being able to come to these events and being able to play with the watch, put it on your wrist, I think it adds a lot of value and it really helps collectors make the purchasing decisions as well. And we're very lucky in Hong Kong that, we have major auction houses coming and showing their watches as an auction preview. And I always treasured those experiences. So I thought, it'd be good to make that more regular so that people can come and share the collections for other people to play with as well.
Very cool. That's really, really cool. And with the monthly get-togethers, obviously, COVID permitting and all of that kind of stuff, is it the same kind of core group that rocks up every month, or do you sort of get, 60 people, but 30 of them are new every time kind of thing?
We usually have a quite engaging core group. Around 20-something people who would always show up whenever we ask.
Always, right. Okay, sure.
Yeah, but we do have a healthy amount of, people who message us on Instagram who wants to join our events because, maybe they came on our website and saw that, this is actually a legit thing,
These events are actually
legit, not just someone who's trying to mug you. rob you of your watch.
One of the questions I had was just that. How do you vet members coming in? If somebody messages you randomly and goes, hey, when's the next get together? I'm sure that you don't just disclose that sort of off the bat. What's the vetting process?
Yeah, so usually there are a few things that we do. We do try to meet them in person, or we have a conversation with them to try to make sure that they're legit. Secondly, we also get people to, pay for the event first. And, with the payment, there's also like a traceable thing that you can always trace back to them to make sure that, we know who they are. We always try to book out a whole venue as well, so that there's not going to be like random people walking in and out.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, so there are many things we do to ensure that the community feels safe to bring their valuable watches to our events to show other members.
Yeah, oh, that's very cool. And so do you guys, you as the three co-founders, do you connect with brands and sort of have, you know, your own presentations? Because I know I saw, I think on your YouTube channel, I think you had like a JLC event. I think it was an Atmos event, which looked amazing to me. Like, well, that would be the one to go to. Have the brands and kind of the local boutiques been receptive to kind of supporting or fostering that kind of relationship with a group of crazy collector people locally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes we approach the brands, sometimes the brands approach us about doing events because – you know, we're very much about promoting horology to our community and then maybe the other watch lovers who are not in our community as well. So it's important for us to have a good balance between, you know, different types of events. So get-togethers are obviously our main thing. Mm. But the other aspect of it is to, you know, partner with a brand to see if they can offer some great experiences for our community. For example, like you said, last year we did an event with JLC where they showcased, you know, how the Atmos clock actually works. And I think that's fascinating to a lot of our members, right? Like, definitely. How's this clock that doesn't need any winding keeps time? So
yeah,
they showcase, yeah, they showcase, you know, how that drum works inside the clock, how it would actually expand and contract under different temperatures. So that was great.
That's awesome.
We also did another event with the Mad Gallery in Hong Kong. You know, they were showcasing the new Legacy Machine Perpetual, which was released, I think, in December last year. So that was really good. You know, we got to see the new watch. We also got to see some of the other MBNF creations that they had, like a lot of HMs, some of the clocks that they do. And I think our members really enjoyed that. So going forward, you know, we're going to be doing some other brand partner events as well. I think we had an IWC watchmaking class scheduled in January, but that unfortunately had to be postponed. So we're very much looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, it's great to hear. It is great to hear kind of the ADs and kind of the stores and the brands themselves actually engaging with the collector community, because I think that's really the best way to get people interested in your product is very much engaging directly with interested people, right, rather than sort of advertising or whatever it is the brands do. So actually, yeah, that's quite a nice thing to hear that, at least the people in Hong Kong understand the importance of fostering the interest of the collector community. So that's very cool. It's good on you and good on them for engaging. MBNF, you mentioned the Mad Gallery. Certainly looking at your YouTube channel, and you've just done a really cool video about the watch that you're wearing at the moment. But you guys have done a couple of videos about MBNF. So is MBNF a sort of brand that's really well represented in the Horology Club membership base? Is there lots of MBNF floating around? Is it a sort of one of the brands that really your group of friends really get behind or enjoy?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have quite a few MBNF fans in our community. I guess, you know, with the popularity of independent watchmaking that came about in the past few years, and I guess MBNF is probably one of the brands that fascinates most people. You know, they're not just like a watch, and paraphrasing Max Buser, he's always saying, you know, this is a kinetic sculpture that just happens to tell time.
Sure.
So I think visually it's very interesting, and maybe that's why a lot of people are drawn to MBNFs. But yeah, we definitely have a good representation, and as you saw in our MBNF video, you know, some of the watches are contributed by our members, which we're very grateful for the video, And yeah, there's a big variety of horological machines and legacy machines that we've seen in the community. And I think there were also quite a lot of people who have ordered MBNFs after coming to our events and experience these pieces. So you know, it seems like it's definitely catching on.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, I'm definitely much more in favor of people buying MBNFs if they see other MBNFs rather than Tiffany blue Rolexes because they seem to see OPs, you know, if you know what I mean, you know. If you're going to do – if people are going to be influenced by peer groups, I would much rather they kind of go down the interesting route rather than the kind of, you know, I'll buy another Royal Oak because there's 10 of them on the table at this get-together. So that's – that's all to be applauded, very much so. So the watch that you've got – let's talk about the watch that you've got on your wrist. So you've got the Mad 1.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That's the blue version.
Yeah, the blue one.
Tell us what you think. And once again, you can be honest, so I can always cut this out if it gets Max, who was a previous guest on the show very early on, you know, he doesn't need to hear about it. If it's negative, we'll cut it.
No, actually, I would say this is probably the Max Busa creation that I wear the most. It is such a great piece. Like, I still remember when I first got the email from the tribe about the watch. I was like, what is this? Like, there was just a picture and there was like a video on YouTube. They didn't mention anything about the dimensions. For me, like I tried on quite a few MBNF pieces in the past, and what really was my main concern on those pieces is that they tend to be a little bit on the larger side. So as someone who has a small wrist, you know, like wearability is key to me. So I started Googling it. How thick is this watch? You know, what's the diameter? There was absolutely nothing, no press release. And then I had to email back to MBNF and ask them about all of this information. But since I've gotten the watch, I actually wear it quite a lot. Even though the stated thickness is 18 millimeters, which is a lot thicker than what I would usually buy.
Yeah, it's a 70, it doesn't actually 750 work, chronograph. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
It wears extremely comfortably because I think because of the lightness of it. I mean, I don't think we need to talk about the secondary market value of it right now because we don't, and
that's almost kind of. I mean, the way I see these kind of things is, it's almost beside the point because people who really want them will buy them. So people who really want them and have supported MBNF before had a chance to buy them before. So you got that marketing. And then the secondary market, if somebody really wants it because they just want to say, I've got an MBNF, but I don't, they'll just buy whatever the value is, they'll just buy it. Right? And it will sort of saturate the market. It'll find its equilibrium somewhere. So we definitely don't need to talk about that. I'm actually more interested in terms of, you know, wearability, which you've mentioned, which is great. The other thing I was going to ask about, reading the time on it, because it's a oblique time display. So, and then thirdly, the spinning rotor, how does that in terms of distractibility and, you know, sort of thing, you know?
Okay. No, great point you've brought up is that reading the time, because, while the Mad one is quite unique, it's also not really an everyday watch.
No.
So, you know, when you read the time, you know, what you do is usually angle your wrist towards your face. But when you do that with the Mad one, you just don't see the time. And it does take some getting used to. So, you know, after a period of wearing other watches and I get back to this and I want to tell the time, it's like, okay, you know, I need to adjust my wrist to another angle to actually see the time. In terms of the time display, you know, because it doesn't really have the single minute markers, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit harder to adjust and a little bit harder to read, but you know, that's really besides the point because when you wear something like this, telling the time precisely isn't really the biggest issue.
Yeah, you don't wear this to a day when you've got business meetings, when you're running minute to minute. It's not a thing. Yeah, got it.
Exactly. Yep. So you know, whenever I want to wear this, it's always about, you know, trying to enjoy having such a special piece. You know, something that I can play around with on the wrist. Which comes to your point about, you know, just the battle axe rotor and how it just rotates on your wrist. It's just something really nice. You know, sometimes you're bored at work,
just play with it,
just have a flick of the wrist, and it just spins around. So, yeah, I think it's really enjoyable. One of the more fun pieces that I have in my collection. It's also about that interaction as well. You know, sometimes when you have a chronograph, it's not always about timing something. But
it's never about the timing. It's a tactile pleasure, and it's never about that. I'm yet to meet somebody who is convincing enough to tell me they bought a chronograph because they needed a chronograph. I'm yet to meet even people who drive cars and race cars. Nobody's like, oh, you know, I needed something. That's all just rubbish, you know. So no, it's good. Do you own any other MBNFs yourself?
Yes, I do. So I have an LM101, which I also wear a lot.
Yeah, that's diametrically opposed MBNF to this one. But it's amazing. Like, a wonderful watch. Probably one of my favorite on that.
Absolutely. Series.
That and the Perpetual. Definitely.
So that would probably be the MBNF that I would wear to a meeting where I had to take minutes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, for me, the draw for that piece is, like I said earlier, wearability is normally key for me. That is a 40 millimeters watch, which makes it one of the smaller MBNFs and one of the most wearable MBNFs. And actually, whenever I wear it, whenever I wear it at our community get-togethers, then people always say, "Oh, I didn't actually realize it's so wearable. You know, it's such an amazing piece because it's simple, it's wearable. You know, it's not like a big puck on your wrist."
That's right. No, absolutely. And that's, look, I mean, I have a lot of respect for what Max does, both in terms of the range of ideas they've managed to do, which is the breadth of creativity is really quite astonishing for a small brand. You know, they've got everything from crazy clocks to really interesting ways to display time, all the way to hyper classical but very futuristic things like the LMs. You know, like LM Perpetual is probably my grail watch if I had a grail watch, you know, like because that is just wonderful on so many levels, both design, execution, horological conception, the way they solve the way Stephen McDonald solved the problem with setting. Like, it's just crazy. It's really cool. So it's actually really interesting that you've got the really classic piece and the really funky piece. And that's probably Max, I would imagine Max would find that really, really good, because like, somebody gets him on both the crazy side and the and a more traditional, still crazy, but more traditional side. That's really cool. That is really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great combination. And, you know, while I said that, you know, like, a lot of the HM pieces are quite big. Like, it's not like, you know, it's something that I wouldn't buy, but it's just, you know, it has its time and place. And I really hope to add an HM piece to my collection in the future. You know, while it's not wearable every day, sometimes you do want to have that big piece. And when I have that, you know, when I have a big watch, I want it to be something that actually is designed to be that way. You know, like, it could be an airplane.
rather than just a jellyfish. Rather than just a Panerai.
You're not buying
a big watch because you want a big watch. Yeah, got it. Very cool. I mean, the other brand I think you've talked about on your channel, the other brand that you guys have talked about is Ervirk.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, that's also really interesting way of displaying time. Now, I'm not sure if it's your own Ervirk that you were talking about before or whether that's somebody from the community that had that. But again, really cool indie brand that does its own thing consistently in an amazing way. So that's very cool to see. Very cool to see.
Yeah. The watch you mentioned on the video, that's my personal watch, the UR103. But we do have quite a lot of Ervirk fans in our community as well. You know, I've definitely seen quite a few cool pieces, like like one of the other co-founders, Jonathan, he has the MBNF and Uber collaboration, the Nitro watch. Oh,
the Nitro? Yeah, wow.
Yeah,
that is awesome.
So that covers that both bases, cool. But we've also seen other stuff like the UR100, you know, 103, so 105. So yeah, a lot of Uber fans in our group. So yeah, I think it's great that people get to come and experience those as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess that's one of the things that we in Melbourne certainly don't have that much exposure to. There's a couple of guys, there's one or two people who've had Urvex, so we get to play with them. But it's Urvex is not a brand that we see a lot here. Yeah, everyone, they're greatly admired, but it's one of the things greatly admired, but not often worn. A bit like JLC, you know, greatly admired. I can't think of three people who actually own them, you know. So anyway, but that's cool to see.
Yeah. Why do you think that is the case? Because, you know, a lot of people are happy to wear watches that are very expensive, you know, maybe like a Nautilus. But, you know, sure. Why won't people actually veer towards the more creative side and get something like an Uber?
So, I mean, I think there is a combination of things. So one is the groupthink, in a sense, where, you know, you almost need a critical mass of exposure before you'll actually tip the scale. So which is why I'm really fascinated by communities, you know, watch collecting communities that spring together, because we certainly see that in Melbourne, for example. So it's like in the Fifth Wrist community, a bunch of us end up having very similar watches because we kind of end up convincing each other about how awesome they are. You know, so, like, you know, like Oxen Junior, I'm sure we as Fifth Wrist probably have, you know, not a quarter of all Oxen Juniors out in the wild, but a sizable chunk of that, you know, because we'll go, this is really cool. Oh yeah, that's really cool. I should get one, you know, and then the next person gets, and then suddenly you get two or three and you go, oh, those guys have it. I feel left out because I don't have one. So, you know, it kind of drives that group thing in a really nice positive way where you just help each other discover cool stuff. So there's, I think, a bit of that. I mean, I think the other thing with Urvex is I think they're just now getting better at explaining what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Or the creativity that they bring is something that, you know, you don't just discover. And certainly they've done some really cool recent collabs, like with Asher Rapkin at Collective, for example. You know, they've done this really cool collaboration, which their collaborating partners, the Collective, have done a really great job of explaining and introducing that brand to a much as well. I think MBNF is blessed in a sense that they have a really charismatic, fantastic communicator who essentially comes out every time they bring a watch and explains the watch in a really cool way, really compelling way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
I mean, that's the good thing. The one cool thing about a new MBNF release is there'll be a little video of on the day of Max actually sitting down behind a desk and explaining the thing in a really compelling way. Urvex don't quite have that. Most brands don't really have that, you know, and Urvex, you know, love those guys a lot. They just, maybe it's the German way of, they don't, you know, Felix and, you know, they just don't explain it as well. Maybe, I don't know. So I think that's partly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you've definitely hit on a great point there. And I think these things are usually quite infectious. And it's the same within our community as well. You know, one person gets an Urvex and then, you know, 2 weeks later, you see two other guys who just got new Urvex.
Yeah,
because they've come and they've seen it, they put it on the wrist and like, okay, you know, like before I thought maybe it would be a bit too crazy. Now that I put it on, you know, it actually feels really nice and they go and get their own one.
Yeah, so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, and I do think particularly with indie watchmakers, that engagement directly with the collecting groups, collecting communities is just so important, essentially at every price level. Doesn't matter if you do crazy stuff or, you know, classical stuff, doesn't matter if it's 5,000, 10,000, 50,000, or even more, that direct engagement between the maker, being able to explain it to the group of people who appreciate what they do, just helps to absolutely drive the sales if we talk purely pragmatically, but also helps to explain what they do. And let's face it, with brands like MB&F, you need to be explained often why it is like this, why it looks like a dog, or why the thing looks like a jellyfish, whatever. And with Felix, and with Urwerk, you do need to, often the beauty of the thing is you don't understand how crazy cool the thing is until they go, well, actually, if you do this, this is what we made it. And if you lift the thing, there's a little winder in the back, you know, all that stuff is really compelling, but it does need a magnetic personality to really deliver that message.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when you buy into MB&F, you're definitely also buying into Max Buser as a character as well. And
yeah,
I think, you know, he's not just a creator. He's also someone who has, I guess, innovated in the modern watchmaking industry. You know, he's one of the first people who started collaborating. He collaborated with Effie Jaun when he was at Arri Winston.
Yeah, Opus One.
V&A Halter, Urwerk. So, you know, maybe it's because of him doing that, then, you know, we start to see a lot of collabs these days also.
Yeah, look, I think so. I think so. And I think the other thing that you mentioned as well is that the openness of the collaborations, you know, because there were always, you know, the brands were collaborating with independent makers since time immemorial, just never really giving the indies credit, whether it's movement design or, you know, whoever it is, whether it's Paul Gerber designing movements for everyone, or Andrea Strella, or Philippe Dufour making grand sonneries for AP. You know, that used to happen a lot, but it's just, I think what Max did, to give him credit, is to put the actual shine a spotlight on the independent makers. And you're right, that certainly helped to establish the independent horology scene, as it were.
Yeah.
No, definitely. Very, very cool. Well, speaking of collaboration, actually, a question I was going to ask you guys about. So I had a quick look on the Horology Club website, and I think you guys were announcing a collaboration, or you were going to do a collaboration. I'm not sure if you can talk about it or not. So I should have pre-checked that with you.
No, I'm happy to talk about it. I guess, you know, right now it's still at a teasing stage, so we're not
embryonic
really,
stage. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We're not
right,
really gotcha. At the launch stage yet, but it's something that is currently in production. So maybe when it gets
exciting.
Done, then we can start, you know, communicating how it actually looks. And the other information about the piece, it's a piece that a collaborative club piece for our members that we're doing with Harbring, which we're
beautiful.
Big fans of.
But
you know,
here.
We want to put our own custom design on it, a design that we think honors traditional horology, but with a modern twist. Which is kind of what we're about as well, because, you know, a lot of people in our community is also quite young. So we want to bring that modern twist to the design. And hopefully it'll come out well. I'm quite confident about that. And we're looking forward to seeing the watch.
Very cool. Can we talk about without talking about the design, because we don't need to hear about that, more about the collaborating process. Was there a reason you picked Harbring? Was Harbring the first choice, or did you go through a few makers who we don't need to talk about until you hit Harbring who were happy to oblige, or was Harbring always the partner you wanted from the outset?
No, Harbring was definitely the first choice. And how this came about is, personally, I'm a big fan of IWC, especially 90s IWC.
Given
Richard Harbring worked at IWC, and he's one of the inventors of, different complications that we see
definitely.
That came about in the 90s, like the IWC retropant and a lot of the complications that are based on the 7750.
Sure.
And when he started his own brand, and I guess, you know, he kept on innovating with the Baijiu movement,
definitely,
but with definitely different complications. And I guess the jumping second, you know, I'm going to review now that the model is based on the Irwin jumping second. Jumping second is one of the complications that I find more fascinating, and one that he hasn't done at IWC as well. For me, the jumping second, you know, like some people may say, oh, it's kind of pointless. It doesn't really give you any additional information, right?
That's awesome. But, no, I'm with you. I'm with you. The dead bait chicken is awesome. I'm with you. I'm 100% with you.
Yeah, it's awesome. But the fact that you have a mechanical watch that has a second's hand that jumps like a quartz watch, just I find really fascinating. And in a way, it is the ultimate stealth watch. You know, nobody knows that you're wearing something mechanical, something valuable on your wrist.
Absolutely.
But I still remember learning about the complication at the beginning of my collecting journey, you know, with watches like Grunfeld 1 Hertz, which I found really cool. Or even, you know, going back in time, learning that even Rolex made a jumping second watch back in the day. I think it was called True Beat. So I think, you know, it's something that I find fascinating. So I think Harbing is a natural choice for us to start with as our first club piece. But, you know, forward, we're hoping to partner with more brands to make more collab club pieces for our community as well.
Very cool. Very, 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 very cool. Well, look, I mean, we can talk about the deadbeat. We can spend the rest of the episode talking about how it ties to old, you know, timekeeping from the precision timekeeping from, you know, way before. Anyway, we don't even need to go that far. That's very, very cool. Now, we've had a couple of people on the show previously as guests who've set up kind of collecting communities. I mean, we mentioned Asher Rapkin before, you know, when we were talking about the Irvine collaboration, but he was a guest on the show a couple of times. And I know he set up this sort of collecting club. We had Scaramanga, who's got, you know, a collector's club based in Spain and Europe. I'm really fascinated by the concept of a club watch because I'm interested in how the design process start. Now, are you a benevolent dictator in your club? As in, you know, you say, we're doing collaboration. It is going to be with Harbring. This is what I've decided it's going to look like, who is in, who is out. Or are you more of a, you know, democratically elected leader, if that's probably the wrong thing, saying, you know, we want to do this thing, let's group together and everyone throw in ideas and we'll design this together. Like, what's your style? What's the club style that you guys have followed? Once again, you don't need to talk about the exact design. I'm actually more interested, hopefully our listeners are as well, about kind of how these sort of things come together behind the scenes.
Okay. I guess for us, it's usually the three co-founders that initiates the project. So, you know, we would reach out to the different brands, you know, start talking to them about the club and our desire to do a club piece. And I guess, you know, we're very fortunate in that, you know, we are somewhat skilled in Photoshop, so we can, you know, play around with the different designs and start injecting in our own elements and try to just, you know, try to make it our own, really.
Okay. Rendering.
So, you know, instead of just, I guess, you know, for some people who don't have that skill, then they would talk to the brands about what they want, and then maybe the brand would do a rendering for them, and then they'll just continually refine that over time. But we have the ability to actually, you know, put that into a picture, which I think a lot of brands do appreciate, because, you know, they see these guys coming in and they already have the design, they have the drawing, and, you know, it makes it easier for them. And for the Harbring piece, that's exactly what we did. You know, we approached them and we already had a design at hand. And, you know, afterwards, it just about, you know, getting their input as well and see how we can change a little bit here and there. But, you know, generally the final design was quite close to what we had originally in mind. And then after we have the finalized design from the brand, we would then approach our members to see, you know, whether it be something that would be of interest to them. So this is generally okay. The approach that we have right now. But, you know, going forward, as our club grows, then, you know, it could be that other people have designs that they want to execute. And I guess as long as we have enough interest in the club for the pieces, then we can always approach the brand and see if we can make that a reality as well.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, thank you for sharing that story, because I mean, I definitely find that interesting. What's the size of the edition that you guys would usually get? Well, with Hubring, can you talk about the size of the number of pieces?
Yeah, so with the Hubring piece, we are doing 10 pieces.
10 pieces, okay, well, cool.
Which is a pretty big run for our community size. But, you know, with different brands that we talk to, some of them do want to do a bigger run as well.
Yeah, so of course. It really depends.
And I think, you know, for the ones that require a bigger run, then maybe it's something that we can look into in the future as our club grows. But for now, we'll focus more on the brands that are happy to do a smaller size run, which would suit us. And, sure. And then those generally tend to be independent brands.
You're not going to get IWC to do a 10 piece of Deadbeat, you know, custom, you know, tantalum piece, you know, that's right, with the perpetual calendar. It'll be a big lift. Thank you for sharing that story, because I think in future that's the way a lot of the brands, certainly the indie brands, are finding niche groups that support them and really get into it. And as we were talking about before, is these things kind of drive themselves. As you get a collecting little hub who really appreciate what you do, and that kind of builds up an addition of 10 pieces or 20 pieces or whatever it is, definitely does help an indie brand certainly establish themselves, or, you know, keep the doors open while they do other stuff. But that's really, really cool. So I am sort of fascinated a bit by that interplay of, you know, benevolent dictator saying, no, this is what we're doing, you know, this is my vision, you know, 10 pieces. I'm sure I'll find 10 pieces, 9 other people. I really want this, so I'm going to have to find 9 other people who'll buy into it, you know, as opposed to trying to design something more democratically by committee, which I would imagine would be a much harder thing to do and probably would end up with a watch that's potentially less original or less daring, you know, or less, dare we say, interesting, you know, if it's co-designed by 10 people.
I think you can't please everyone. It's really hard. Sure. And I still remember, I think Max Bucer said this, or he was paraphrasing Günter Blümlein, you know.
The design process is not
a democracy. So,
we usually
have inputs from other people as well. But I think it's ultimately the project owner who should, you know, make the ultimate decision as to what, you know, what feedback they do and do not take in. Yeah.
Sure. Well, presumably, and it's also the project leader who then ends up with 7 unsold watches as well. So only fair, when I say unsold, you know, it's Christmas presents for the in-laws, and then you kind of pass it out, you know. that's very true. I think you're right. I think I heard the same interview. I think Max was talking about Günter Blümlein. That's right. I think they were arguing about some design thing at JLC. And he said, well, it's my decision, because, you know, creativity is not a democracy. That's right. So, which is a really bold thing to say, and certainly a very bold thing to implement, right?
Yeah.
In a company like MBNF, right? So if you're an MBNF, you go, well, no, we're making it like this because that's what Max sees as his creation. And then you've got to try and convince, you know, 10 people, 20 people, whatever it is, convince the world to want it, which is why Max is so good at what he does. Yeah, it's the magnetism and the of the guy is really infectious. So that's very cool. No, look, I mean, congratulations on getting the the custom piece off the ground. It's always, I always love seeing those club pieces from different collecting communities, because if they're done well, they do reflect the kind of the culture or the group or the personality really well. You know, I mean, when they're done well, you know, it's not just like, oh, it's a blue dial or it's a Tiffany blue. It's a standard, but with the Tiffany blue hand or something. You're like, oh, okay, that's less interesting. So no, well done to you. So well, when do you expect the pieces kind of up on wrists?
So I am expecting them to be delivered maybe Q3 this year, hopefully.
Oh, wow, but okay.
With the demand for independent watches these days, then, you know, I think they probably have a quite full order book. So it wouldn't be surprising me if there were delays. But, you know, hopefully Q3 this year, I'll be able to share with you the design
of
the watch. And, you know, you can get a feel of what we're all about. But
that's awesome.
We are in talks with other brands about, you know, doing other pieces as well. And I guess for Harbouring, it's mostly a traditional design, but going forward, we're hoping to be able to move into something more daring and more creative.
Oh, exciting. Yeah. And so do you think setting up the first collaboration has kind of opened up the appetite from the members in your group who are like, oh, we've done one, you know, like having done one, do you think that now like the interest has perked up for people to go like, oh, we should do three a year? You know, like, is that a thing that's now happened, like generated its own momentum?
I don't think that members generally, you know, like demand pieces to be done.
Really? Okay. You know? Okay. Well, we got the more activated then. Come on.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, they're happy to see them. They're happy to buy them. But, you know,
but they're not hassling you to design the next one. Well, yeah, which is good. I mean, that's actually quite nice. That, you know, they're not beating on your door saying, come on, it's been 2 months since the last one. We, you know, the people need another watch kind of thing. Nice.
And we also don't want to be bringing out like five collab pieces a year, because, you know, while we love collab pieces and we love to use that as a tool to promote modern horology, I guess our main raison d'etre is more about the community aspect of it, you know, bringing people together, bringing collectors together. Yeah. So
cool.
It's something nice to do on the side, but
it's not your core business.
It's not our main focus.
No, that's cool. Oh, look, I mean, good on you. I mean, as I said, like all success to you. Always great to see kind of cool people combining together into a little community or a hub, shared interest, and if they can then, get like a club piece, that's awesome. That's wonderful. One thing, just to finish up on the club bit, one thing I was interested in seeing is I had a look on the website, and you guys have a sales forum as well.
I
don't think I've seen in other groups before. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, all of the pieces that are on sale on our website are consigned by our community members. So, you know, currently we don't take any sort of fee for, you know, helping them sell the watch. We're just providing a platform for our members, you know, just to help them a little bit in terms of, you know, helping to sell their pieces.
Right.
You know, hopefully, like, we let the members price the watches however they like.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask.
Yeah.
So is it members selling to members, or is it members selling to the world kind of thing?
We have facilitated quite a few sales between members. And I guess, you know, when members go on the site, they see these watches and they see, okay, they compare it to Chrono 24 prices, maybe it's a little bit lower. Then they'll see, okay, it's a good opportunity for me to get this watch at this price. And we're doing this because we recognize that selling pieces is part of collecting. You know, people like, you know, they may got a watch 5 years ago that, you know, they may not enjoy anymore. Or the prices have gone up a lot and they want to use that money to convert it into a piece that they've always wanted. And I guess given that selling is part of the journey, then we just want to provide a service for our members to make this journey as pleasant as possible for them.
I think it's another one of those things where helping members to, you know, it's part of the collecting journey, as you were saying. You know, we all have limitations of our means, whatever that number of zeros that limitation has at the end of the of the number. Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually really cool to see, you know, that kind of members banding together to create like platforms for exchanging watches or selling watches. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really cool way to evolve the community. I know we use that word a lot, but it's a really cool way to for people to kind of engage with the hobby together in a supported mm-hmm. way kind of thing. So that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Really cool. We can offer like photography services to help them, you know, take pictures of their watches.
Oh, wow. You guys come and you're not charging sales fees yet. Oh, wow.
No,
amazing.
No.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Well, if any member of yours is listening, you know, if you want to sell, get in now before these guys really turn the screws on you.
Well, I mean, you know, if in the future a lot of people want to consign their pieces
and do a big effort,
then, you know.
Yeah, of course. If somebody's delivering a tray of 100 watches to sell, you got to draw a line. I get it. Look, that's very, very cool. And thinking sort of ahead, what's your plan? Like, what's the plan for the Horology Club? Is there like a master vision, you know, global domination in 3 years? Like, is there a plan ahead?
Well, I mean, for now, we are still very much concentrating in Hong Kong. Like I said earlier, we focused on live events, and given all three of us co-founders are based in Hong Kong, then it makes sense for us to focus on building a community in Hong Kong first.
Sure.
But in the future, if there's a demand in other countries, then, you know, we're very happy to expand to that as well. But, you know, for now, we're no red bar. We just want to focus on our little local community, get more interest in our club, and just see where we go from there. And we'll try and, you know, facilitate that by doing different things like organizing a variety of events, you know, not just get-togethers where people sit around, talk about watches. Maybe we can do other stuff like, you know, watch trivia night, maybe movie screenings like, you know, the recent Keeper of Time film. That'll be
good. Yeah, it was great.
Screening to show to our members. Yeah, yeah.
So
we have aspirations to grow and see how, you know, whether we can actually get older watch collectors in Hong Kong into a single group. And, you know, maybe in the future, we can do more stuff. Like right now, travel is restricted in Hong Kong. But you know how, you know, the watch auctions twice a year in Hong Kong, and we do get quite a lot of international collectors coming in. So it would be good to do something for the people who are coming in for the watch auctions as well. You know, expand our footprint, you know, get our name out there to be known by the international collectors.
There you go. That sounds like global domination to me. You know, give it a year or two. No, that's awesome. It's really good. You know, I'm all about kind of grassroots, kind of people discovering a shared interest and coming together to enjoy the hobby, whether it's watches or stamp collecting or, you know, slow jazz or whatever it is people kind of jazz about. So it's really cool to see. And it does sound like you guys have built this kind of quite organically built this really core group that are really enjoying each other's company and some really cool watches. So that's awesome.
I'm so grateful for the community that we have and the level of engagement that we've seen. I guess there are quite a lot of passionate watch collectors in Hong Kong, so I'm just glad that we found them, you know, we put them together in their room and get them interacting with each other.
No one's killed each other yet, so that's kind of you know, that's give it time, as always say. It's been awesome having this conversation, because I think there's a lot of similarities between kind of Hong Kong collectors and Australian collectors, and hopefully as the travel restrictions lift, hopefully we'll kind of get to meet each other because we're sort of on the same part of, you know, same hemisphere. So hopefully we'll get an opportunity to meet and interact. But it's been awesome having you on the show. It's been such a fun conversation. I'm glad we managed to do it.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm so humbled to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. There's no need to be humble. It's just you know, a couple of enthusiasts just wasting our Friday night, really, instead of being out on the town. Well, look, usually what we do before we finish up, you know, we try to do like an Instagram recommendation or something. And essentially the purpose of it is to kind of expand our listeners' awareness, broaden their horizons, really, is probably the better phrase. Do you know if you've got anything prepared, if there's any recommendations you wanted to do, Instagram, social media, watch, you know, watches, blogs, books, whatever it is. We're pretty democratic about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to give a shout out to one of our community members, actually. Nice. His account on Instagram is at Perpetual Horology. I think it's Perpetual _ Horology. He's a great watch photographer. He always, you know, whenever he shows up to our events, he takes a lot of photos of the watches, and his photos are amazing. He also teaches watch photography classes. So oh, wow. I actually first met him at an IWC watch photography class where he taught me how to do like a flat lay photo, you know, putting props around the watch to frame it well. And I've learned a lot from him. So, you know, go check out his account, check out his photos, and give him a follow as well.
Very cool. Also, brave move to pick one favorite member of your community. Good luck at the next at the next get together.
he's definitely a very valued member of our community, and I just love his photos.
I'm just having a look at them now. I'm just having a look at his photos now, and they are incredible. I'm always I'm always jealous of people who just seemingly, you know, effortlessly throw out like a glorious photo, and like I could never do that. So no, that's very cool. That's a great recommendation. So no, thank you for that. Alrighty, maybe I'll do one as well then. Let me have a look. Let's do an Instagram one as well. So the person I'll recommend is at @rare_horology. There's a guy named Marcus. I don't know if you know Marcus, but he's got this sort of insane collection of indie watches. He's not a collection of watches, full stop. But, you know, in terms of indies, you know, he's got everything from Kodoki and Chapek to Moser and Ervirk and some pretty kick-ass MBNF pieces as well. So shout out to Marcus, rare_horology. Just dreams are made of that collection. Like, that's just awesome. And also cool photos as well. Really good photos. So,
have come across his account. I haven't spoken to him on Instagram, but I love his collection.
Yeah.
Amazing pieces.
Yeah,
I think I remember seeing a video of his like watch box where he showed just like a huge collection of indie pieces.
Yeah,
made me truly jealous.
Yeah. Yeah, we say it with love, we hate you. Anyone collecting indie pieces is a hero in my book. Like, you know, it's to do that. You know, do that. More people do that. More power to that. All right. Well, look. Helbert, it's been such a pleasure to have you in the show, man. It's been, great fun. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The last thing we always say is, you know, with Fifth Wrist, we set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. If you're out there listening, you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or come on the show, please get in touch. Love meeting new people. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Also join our Slack group. Lots of fun conversations there. The filters really come off. So you'll know exactly how I feel about Rolex if you join the Slack group. Like and subscribe to the podcast as well. And please do send us reviews and feedback. Really want to know how we make the show more interesting and, more engaging for you. Follow me. I'm at @TimesRomanAU. My awesome guest, Helbert, is at Hellboy, which is Hell Boi, which is an awesome handle. I'm jealous of that handle. It's just unbeatable on that. Also, check out the Horology Club at the.horology.club and at www.thehorologyclub.com. Thank you for joining us today. And as we always say, stay on time.
Fifth Wrist is by the community, for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.